You're listening to the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast. I'm Sarah, and I am on my own today because this is a wild card episode. Andy and I got a chance to go to the Getty Sing Conference in Nashville a little bit ago, and we've been surrounded by many fellow hymn nerds, which has been an amazing experience, and musicians and creatives. And so I have the privilege today of sitting down with an incredibly talented artist for what I know is going to be a fantastic conversation. Joining me today is Malcolm Geit, a poet, priest, musician, life fellow of Girton College, Cambridge, 5 volumes of poetry, several books on Christian faith and theology, including a highly acclaimed biography of Samuel Taylor Coleridge, lectured widely on the fantasy writings of J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, which I know our audience loves, and currently undertaking your own epic retelling of the legends of King Arthur. That's
a big project. Yeah. I've wanted to do it all my life, you know, since my mother told me those stories when I was little. And I think the time has come for all kinds of reasons to tell them again. They have something new to teach every generation, but it is a big undertaking.
Yeah.
So I'm traveling a little less. You know, I was mainly known for writing sonnets, which is a wonderfully compressed form, you know.
Yeah.
And I can just about write a sonnet in an airport lobby, but I can't write an epic. So I have to block off fairly big blocks of time at home. But I wouldn't miss this Sing conference. I mean, I've been coming here for 4 years now as a sort of poet in residence at Sing, which is a kind of weird title, but it's got a great buzz here. I know you meet lots of really interesting people, and the Gettys themselves are, you know, wonderfully dynamic and interesting people to be with.
Yes, so. They are. Yes. Did you ever think you would be a poet in residence for a conference about hymnody?
No, I didn't. That wasn't on, you know, it's not something I envisioned when I was about 16 and first thought I want to be a poet. But it's an adventure, you know. One of the things you mentioned, Tolkien, and one of the things I like about the Tolkien legendarium, that both Bilbo and later Frodo are called, you know, by Gandalf effectively to unexpected adventure when they're in their 50s.
That's true.
If you think about it, I mean, okay, hobbits are more long-lived, but I feel very much like that particularly the last sort of decade of my life as a poet is suddenly taken off for various reasons. And I see it as a series of unexpected adventures, you know?
Yeah, very much so. And we'll get back to Tolkien and Lewis, hopefully at some point. I know this is going to be a circuitous conversation and it's going to be so fun, but I'm sure people can tell by your accent you're not really from around Nashville area.
No, I'm not.
Tell us a little bit of your story, your background. You have a very interesting story.
Yeah. How long have you got? So anyway, I'm half. I'm a Brit. I use the word Brit or British quite carefully. I'm half English, half Scottish. So two of the kingdoms of the United Kingdom I cover both. My mother is Scottish, was Scottish. My father was an Englishman. Hugely formative for me, both of them. I mean, obviously everybody's parents are formative, but I'm particularly grateful to them. My mother, I mean, it's through my mother that the poetry comes. She was a great storyteller. She had an enormous fund of poetry. I didn't realize this was unusual until I started meeting other kids, you know, at school. And I would say, like, you know that thing when your mum recites the rhyme of the ancient mariner to you and they go like, what? And I was like, doesn't everybody's mum do that? So she had this huge fund of poetry and song, great memory. Her mother, my grandmother on that side, was a poet, was a published poet in Scotland in Glasgow. So that sort of flows through there. And she didn't, to make it clear, it's not that she sat me down in a chair and said, this is poetry, it's good for you, you've got to have 10 minutes of this before playtime. It was nothing like that at all. She would just naturally, it would flow out of her and you'd just feel the lift. So I was, in spite of being coming across as this very British person, I was actually born in Nigeria.
Yeah.
And my first name, in fact, is Ayodeji, which means joy again. It's a Yoruba name. But although we lived in Nigeria and then in Zimbabwe, my dad, you know, taught classics, Greek and Latin there, but we came back to England every year so that he could do his research in, you know, Cambridge. And my mother wouldn't fly. So it meant me and my sister went with my mother on these wonderful slow boats, as it were, from Africa every year. My mother had been in the Wrens in the war and was a real sort of sailing and, you know, sea person. So just to give you an example of you know, what she would do, we'd be sat, still stood together on the deck of the boat, you know, as the sun was going down, you know, in kind of the South Atlantic or something. And she'd say, out beyond the sunset, could I but find the way, is a sleepy blue laguna that widens to a bay. And there's the blessed city, or so the sailors say, the golden city of St. Mary. And I'm going like, what? You know, the idea of getting behind the sunset. So you just do that, or she quote bits. So I was very fortunate that I grew up with that. And my father was, you know, keen on literature too. So I was, my grandfather had the theory that you should expose kids to the best literature from the get-go. Mm-hmm. So I literally had Milton and Shakespeare read to me in the cradle, you know. So it's all in there somewhere. So that was very fortunate. And then we, when I was 10, we left Africa. My dad got a job in Canada. Mm-hmm. He was a professor of classics at McMaster University in Hamilton. Mm-hmm. So I suddenly went from being a kind of mixture of British and African to being a Canadian kid. Uh-huh. And then, you know, as I was about to go into high school, you know, beginning of the 70s, my dad was worried that I was, this is very ironic, really, he was worried I was losing my British identity. So so he sent me to a boarding school in England. You know, it was a great school, one of the great London schools, but it was very traumatic for me. You know, yeah. I'd never been away from home. I got what my father was doing and I agreed to it, but I didn't really know what I was letting myself in for. And yeah. I found that quite traumatic, the sort of being a lonely boy in a boarding school. Also this weird split identity where in term time I was a buttoned up English schoolboy. And, you know, in the holidays, I was a kind of Canadian kid listening to Neil Young and Joni Mitchell. It was kind of, you know, it's like, so it was quite difficult to negotiate. And in the course of that, in the sort of crisis of, you know, all the usual adolescent Sturm und Drang, I lost the faith which I had, well, I deliberately abandoned the faith which I'd received almost just by osmosis from my parents. But I was, you know, it was quite an aggressively secular school in its own way. And we were very much fed the agenda that, you know, all this religious stuff is from the childhood of humanity, and now we're grown up and we're there to know, and we leave these fairy tales behind, and science explains everything. But the science that explained everything was a very reductive science. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, we're all just unwinding enzymes and the self-replication of a selfish gene, that stuff.
Yeah.
Which, you know, just does not account for any of the heights or depths of or innerness of human experience. Yeah. And so I tried my best to follow that, and I really went for it, and I was going to be a scientist, and I was, you know, I was a very ardent, strident kind of atheist in my mid-teens. Mm-hmm. But then poetry came back into my life. And poetry had always been there because, you know, and I was taken by one of my aunts to Keats's house in Hampstead Heath, and I didn't really know anything about Keats. But I stood in the room where the magic casements open, and there's the tree where the nightingale sang, and they had the Ode to Nightingale up on the wall. And I read it and was just completely mesmerized. I read it more and more, you know. And first of all, because it starts, you know, with you quite moody. I was a moody adolescent, you know, my heart aches and a drowsy numbness pains my sense, you know, as though hemorrhage. Yeah. But then, you know, he hears the bird and he's drawn out, and suddenly you get this beautiful, I mean, you get the thou light-winged dryad of the trees in some melodious plot of beech and green and shadows numberless singest of summer in a full-throated. I was like, what was that? I was reading it again and again, and I was like the kid at the back of an Eric Clapton concert playing air guitar. You know, I want to sound like that. But you may remember in that poem, suddenly out of nowhere, you get two beautiful, they're not logically related images, but they're there. Suddenly, in the midst of this poem, appears the biblical figure of Ruth. Mm. He imagines that Ruth, too, has heard a nightingale. When sick for home, she stood in tears amidst the alien corn, you know. And I recognize my homesickness, mm-hmm. but I recognize that there was a transcendent element to it. And then, of course, it finishes about magic casements opening mm-hmm. on perilous seas in fairylands forlorn. It's like there's a window at the back of the poem that's taking you into something completely transcendent. So now, Keats was not a Christian. It's not a Christian poem. The poem didn't in itself, you know, give me back my faith mm-hmm. and make me a Christian. But what it did, and I think all great art can do this, I mean, I think it's happening a lot now to some of the so-called new atheists of our own age. That's breaking up. Mm-hmm. And now we're having in England what's being nicely called a quiet revival. You know, anyway, the point is, what that poem did, standing in that house and reading it again and again, was it basically cracked open the kind of layers of concrete reductivism that I'd poured over the wellsprings of my own imagination. And it said, no, there's more. Whatever else is going on in this poem, it's more than firing synapses and unwinding enzymes. Mm-hmm. There's something. So what that poem did is it kind of cracked open the carapace and allowed me to be aware of spiritual resonance. It took a little longer. I got to Cambridge. I was fortunate to win a scholarship to study literature at Cambridge, and Cambridge has been in my orbit ever since, really. But I chose particularly to specialize in medieval and Renaissance literature. Mm. So everybody I read was Christian,
yeah.
You know, and trying to understand Milton, trying to understand Spencer, you know, I needed to read some background theology, you know, so I read Augustine's Confessions as a background.
Yeah.
And I sort of thought, well, that, the thing about Augustine's Confessions, or anything by Augustine, but the, you walk into that book, and it's like going in one of those really little doors inside the big door in a cathedral. You go through the little door of the cover of the book, mm-hmm. and you're in this vast, capacious place. You realize this mind is very considerably more capacious and better furnished than mine is. Mm-hmm. So the entire idea that Christianity is for dummies, or that we've outgrown it, or that we're somehow more intellectually or philosophically sophisticated, you only have to read a theologian of that caliber to have that completely blown away. Mm-hmm. And you realize, you know, there is more than enough to satisfy the most rigorously searching intellect and to draw it further in, you know, in the Christian faith, in the gospel. So that was really important. Eventually, these things came together, partly also with reading the Psalms, allegedly for background to poetry. But I eventually had I realized there was much more to Christianity than I thought. I couldn't dismiss it so easily. I became skeptical about my skepticism. But eventually God made himself a little bit plainer and clearer with a real sense of his presence in the room and various things. So I returned to my faith in end of 79, which was my beginning of my final year at Cambridge. And I was confirmed, you know, in the Anglican Church in February of 1980. So, and of course, the great thing about returning to my faith was because poetry had had so much to do with preparing the way. I mean, I don't know if perhaps your listeners are familiar with C.S. Lewis's wonderful spiritual autobiography, Surprised by Joy.
Mm-hmm, yes.
He says effectively, he's reflecting on reading George MacDonald, but he says in that book, I suppose in a way my imagination was baptized before I was, but the rest of me took a bit longer to catch up.
Yeah.
And that really was my experience. So because of that, when I then came back to Cambridge 10 years later and did theology as part of preparing for ministry, mm-hmm. I was really keen to think about the theology of the imagination, about the imagination as a kind of proto-evangelism, as a kind of opening up of possibilities, and the need to integrate reason and imagination together in a full, you know, apprehension of faith. So eventually I thought those issues through at a fairly fundamental level and wrote a book, which was kind of my sort of academic monogram, which is a book called Faith, Hope and Poetry, mm-hmm. Theology and the Poetic Imagination. And I've developed those ideas since, but I was very fortunate to be part of what was the beginning of a renaissance, really, of theologically, of thinking about theology and the arts. I was working with Jeremy Begbie, who, you know, is a tremendous theologian of music. And so, yeah, that's been academically very important to me. But there came a point where I realized, actually, I'd always wanted to be a poet. So I didn't want, you know, the thing about literary criticism is wonderful, but you can almost end up killing your own creative spirit because you're too over-analytic. So I at a certain point in the course of my early ministry after my ordination, I reconnected with that earliest wish to be a poet. Mm-hmm. And I started wanting to be a poet in Keats's house. You know, I was a wannabe Keats, you know, which meant that when I did write poetry and really focus on it, I was very interested in the music and the sound of the words and in craft and form, mm-hmm. which I felt was missing from a lot of contemporary poetry anyway. So that sort of became my niche.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, long answer to a short question.
No, I have a million questions and we don't have 3 days to talk, unfortunately. But I mean, you talk about George MacDonald. We had one of our previous book club episodes was The Princess and the Goblin.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's such a, that. My mother comes to MacDonald. I had those children, the Princess and the Goblin, the Princess and Curdie were read to me and my sister by
excellent.
My mother when we were little. Now, my mother, as I mentioned, is Scots. And My mother and my grandmother were both huge MacDonald fans. Yeah. So my mother not only had all the, you know, the princess books and so on, but she had the Scottish novels, and of course she could read them. And so MacDonald was important anyway. I mean, I read Fantasties and Lilith, actually at my mother's recommendation. I was thinking, boy, these are really mind-blowing. Like, my mother has asked me to read this because they're mind-blowing books. But in fact, I continued my interest in MacDonald. I've written a little on you know, MacDonald and Lewis. So there was a very good conference, I think, jointly by the Lewis and MacDonald societies on the Inklings' Victorian forebears. I also then wrote about Coleridge's influence on MacDonald, because MacDonald was a huge Coleridge fan. And now, for my sins, I'm actually the honorary president of the George MacDonald Society. So last year, of course, was the bicentenary of MacDonald's birth. So there were four sort of major international conferences, all of which I found myself speaking. So I had a big MacDonald year last year.
You know, you're talking about Princess and Curdie, Princess and the Goblin, C.S. Lewis. You bring up imagination. I know fantasy literature is something you love, and that is a love of many of our listeners, one of mine as well. What is it about fantasy literature of Tolkien and Lewis that, I don't know, that helps us understand our Christian faith even
Well,
deeper?
I think, you know, there's lots of ways of talking about that. The Inklings, when they were writing about what they, I mean, Lewis particularly used a particular word which he thought to describe what he thought MacDonald did in great excellence, but it was also what he and Tolkien were doing. He used the word mythopoeic. Now, Greek mythos, story, poes means to make. So, you know, you could say that's just a fancy Greek way of saying story making. But they used it because they wanted to suggest that there's a level of writing which is, it's not common day-to-day realism. It's not, you know, it's not simply trying to replicate in print your own experience of this world. It's definitely about re-entering an enchantment, which a world which is drenched in meaning. Mm-hmm. But they would very clearly, by using mythopoeic, they're saying it's not allegory. It's not that the author has a bunch of moral lessons he'd like to teach you or things he'd like to say, and that, you know, then he translates them, you know, he finds some equivalent in fiction very symbolically. And all you do is got to decode it. And when you've decoded it, you get exactly the meaning the author had in mind and no more. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of writing allegory which Tolkien famously said he cordially disliked. What they meant was that the human mind and the depth of the imagination, especially the imagination, knows more than we do. There's a deeper wisdom, and that story knows more than we do. That a great story, a story which is working at the level of myth, mythopoeic, is actually older and wiser than we are. And even the author writing the story doesn't know everything that's in it. And a really great story is continuously suggesting more. I mean, when Lewis reviewed The Lord of the Rings when it came out, he used the word mythopoeic, and he said, this is not conscious allegory, but it is continually suggestive of incipient allegory. Every time you read it, you see things that you wouldn't have otherwise seen.
Yeah.
So he gives the famous example that when the Ring story came out in the 50s, this whole question of we have this thing but we don't use it and we must somehow get rid of it, everybody assumed it was an allegory about nuclear weapons and the development of the atom bomb and everything. And, you know, and the problem of nuclear disarmament. And Tolkien and Lewis were having a good laugh about this because he'd got the plot and written the thing long before the atom bomb had been invented.
Right.
But the story was wise. And we can take it even further. I mean, if I think now about what Tolkien was inspired to do, essentially, The Lord of the Rings is an epic of renunciation. It's not about seeking the treasure and getting it. It's about having the treasure and losing it in order to gain something much, much better. Now, if you think that we're consuming ourselves to death, if there was ever a great story needed by an age of morbid consumption, it's an epic of renunciation. You know, and that's what he gave us. Now, I don't think he was consciously knowing the crummy way we'd be living in the 21st century, but the story was wise. And of course, just the difference between Gandalf and Saruman, you know. So it's continually suggestive of incipient allegory. And the question arises, how does that work? How can a work of art know more than the artist who made the work of art knew? So that the artist, MacDonald is very clear about this. He's got a wonderful essay on the uses of imagination and on the fantastic. He deliberately says, my children readers may know more and get more wisdom out of this story than I consciously knew when I wrote it, because I was being obedient to the imagination and to the story and the imagination. So how does that work? So I would say one of the key things is there in the account of poetry and what poetry actually is, which Shakespeare gives us in A Midsummer Night's Dream, where he's describing the poet, and he says, the poet's eye in fine frenzy rolling doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. And then this is the key thing. As imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. And he prefaces that by saying a little earlier in the speech that imagination apprehends more than cool reason ever comprehends. And after that account of imagination, he says, if it would but apprehend some joy, it comprehends some bringer of that joy. So he sets up this thing between apprehension and comprehension, and also between heaven and earth, earth, heaven. The question is, the apprehended, the fleetingly glimpsed, the beautiful insight that you can't quite put your finger on and that you wish to return to, but it flies, even as you apprehend it. How do I woo that into comprehension? So what the imagination does, according to Shakespeare, is it makes, it shapes, it bodies forth the form of things unknown. So it's a way of knowing. There are things which remain unknown to you until somebody makes the shape or the story or the myth into which those unknown things flow. And it's a habitation. And that's why you find when you go to a finite work of art, like a Shakespeare play, or this is true of music, or, one of the Narnia books, or the play, every time you return to the maid-shaped house of that book and walk into its rooms, you find more. There's, new truths have popped in through the windows or walked in through the back door, and you meet them in this place. So it's an almost infinite source, even though it's a finite book that you can close the covers of. So there's something there. Now, I've always loved that description of poetry, but one of perhaps it is original, but when I was thinking about, I'd always known that even in my atheist and agnostic days as the best account of poetry ever, the heaven, earth, earth, heaven, bodying forth, everything. But it was only when I came to write Faith, Hope, and Poetry, where I was revisiting great moments in literature, this time in a theological frame and thinking about what I believe about God and how he meets us in Christ, I suddenly thought, this is really familiar, this earth, heaven, heaven, earth, how do we connect the two? How can we know anything that we really have? We know what? And I thought, Shakespeare is riffing on the prelude to John's Gospel. If you think about it, you think about the beginning of John's Gospel, that prelude, and in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the same was with God, and you're going, it's going round and round up there in glorious abstract Greek. Mm-hmm. And the reader is thinking, I'm sure this is really profound, but it's kind of, it's above my, and then suddenly, all this about the Logos, and you can read what Heraclitus thought of the Logos, it's a huge reach into the idea of logos or meaning, or what is the coherence behind the coherence of the cosmos, all that stuff. And saying it's there in the beginning. And then suddenly, verse 14, you get, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. Glory. So the glory is now comprehensible. And then, of course, the first question of the disciples, to Jesus in John is, Master, where are you staying? I mean, Shakespeare would have also known it in Latin, Magister ubi habitas. Where is your habitation? Mm-hmm. And of course, because John is riffing on Genesis, that's a beautiful chiasmus with the first question of God to humanity.
Yeah.
Where are you? You're hiding, So now God is, inviting us to find him. And Jesus, of course, replies, come and see. Come and see. So I think Shakespeare is saying, when he says imagination bodies forth, that's exactly, if you like, an Englishing of made flesh. Mm-hmm. I think he's saying that every little bodying forth that a poet or an artist of any kind does is a kind of internal echo, is kind of dependent upon, takes its form and possibility from the great bodying forth of all meaning in all of heaven into all of earth, fully in the person of Jesus Christ, God. You know, and he therefore brings what we could only apprehend into the realm of comprehension. And we say, where are you staying? Where's your habitation? He says, come and see. And, you know, so I think he was just and of course, Midsummer Night's Dream is set BC. It's supposed to be in Athens, you know.
Right.
Although it's Athens with a curious patch of English woodland up just behind it, you know, with the fairy queen. But the point is, I think Shakespeare is nodding his cap and saying, this is where we're all coming from. Every one of us makes in the way that we were made,
mm-hmm.
and with the pattern of the God who chooses to be incarnate, who takes the risk of bodying forth. Mm-hmm. And of course, Tolkien says that in his poem Mythopoeia, we make still by the law by which we're made. And then having thought, I've got this poetry incarnation thing going, yes, I've discovered something. I'm just reading C.S. Lewis's Reflections on the Psalms, and casually, in, you know, a kind of, he says, every poem is a little incarnation.
Well,
you got there first, Jack. So what I think is, now that's not to say that obviously the great archetypal incarnation of meaning, all of meaning and all of love in Christ is the primary thing. We partake in that. We participate in that. Now, if we're Christian, we consciously do. We say we're in Christ. We invite, you know, we can do that magnificently. But I think, you know, he is the one in whom all things hold together. I think if you take the Colossians Christ hymn and John together, which are actually very resonant, and then you ask yourself, well, what about people who are concerned with words and meanings and bodying forth who don't yet know the gospel? Is God suddenly absenting himself from that? No, he's created the very principles by, you know, those people are made in the image of God. So that led me to the conclusion that when poets from any walk of life or culture are writing really at depth, are in touch with that deeper level of imagination, they can sometimes bear witness to the gospel without even knowing that they're doing it. Or there's something in them that, you know, so I have a chapter in Faith Open Poetry called Doubting Faith and Reticent Hope, in which I take three self-consciously atheist poets and show how I think, you know, the poet in them knew more than the philosopher in them. You know, Thomas Hardy would be a classic example of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Thomas Hardy had a, you know, famously bleak view of human life as being, you know, tragedy, a tragedy set in a void, you know.
Yeah.
Chesterton once said that, so wittily, but perhaps a little unfairly, he said, what we have experienced in Thomas Hardy is the village atheist brooding on the village idiot.
Oh, no.
But then Tom Hardy writes The Darkling Thrush.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where as a poet, he's trying to do, I'm the bleak novelist, you know, and you may remember that poem, you know, I leant upon a coppice gate when frost was spectre grey, the winter's dregs made desolate the weakening eye of day, the tangled vine stems scored the sky like strings of broken lyres, and all mankind that haunted nigh had sought their household fires. And you're going, okay, fair enough, it's bad, it's worse than I thought, you know, and he's building up all these, you know, bleak, tangled, broken, you know, all of that. And he has another verse like that, you know, about the clouds are like a cloudy canopy over the crypt of the dying year. And, you know, he could have stopped there. But then, you know, in the final verse he says, when all at once there rose among the bleak twigs overhead a full-hearted even song of joy illimited, an aged thrush, something gaunt and frail, with blast-beruffled plume, had chosen thus to fling his soul upon the gathering gloom. So little cause for carolings of such ecstatic sound was written on terrestrial things afar or nigh around, that I could think there trembled through his happy midnight air some blessed hope whereof he knew and I was unaware. I mean, it's amazing, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, it's wonderful to finish a poem of such supreme awareness with the word unaware.
Yeah.
But you see how he's trying to guard himself, like the the atheist, you know, in him is saying, don't get too carried away. You know, I could think this. I'm not saying I did think it, you know, all of that. But you notice in order to express this moment of of Revelation, this epiphany of the thrush singing on the last day of the 19th century. You know, he has to borrow the language of faith. Mm-hmm. He has to talk about a full-hearted evensong, you know, and he's using words like joy and hope, you know, which are the words that have been kept alive by Christians in a secular culture, because the secular culture has no basis for either joy or hope. You know, it's just reductive. Mm-hmm. So I've come to the view that, you know, one of the roles of the arts, and particularly if you like the mythopoeic arts, is to keep that hope and joy alive in a world which can't account for either hope or joy. And I think in that sense, writers like Lewis and Tolkien and MacDonald become more and more important for us with every passing year.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about your poetry. You've referenced it a couple of times. Tell us about your poetry and maybe share some with us too.
Okay, so I kind of wanted to be a poet really from the time I had this kind of epiphany in its own way of in Keats's house. Mm-hmm. Hardy's poem is called The Darkling Thrush. And the word darkling is borrowed from Keats's Ode to a Nightingale, where Keats says, "Darkling, I listen." It's a very interesting word. And partly Hardy's going, hey, you got a nightingale, I got a thrush, you know. But he's nevertheless saying it's the same transcendent experience. So I wanted that. And because Keats was the person who ushered me into the realm of poetry, the realms of gold, as Keats called it, I've always loved one of the most distinctively Keatsian things is the sound. Keats and Tennyson between them have the music. So Keats is using meter, but he's using all the other things, rhyme, rhythm, assonance, alliteration, and just the sheer sound. As I said, you know, some melodious plot of beech and green and shadows numberless. And a lot of the 19th century poets learned from him. So the person who probably learned most from Keats how to play the beautiful instrument of the English language and make her musical again was Tennyson. I mean, Eliot said that Tennyson had the best ear. So, you know, the moan of doves in immemorial elms, the murmur of innumerable bees, you know?
Okay.
So I just felt when I looked around at contemporary poetry that that was missing.
Yeah.
It was all really kind of cut up and jagged and, you know, didn't seem to have meter or rhyme. And I thought, well, nobody's doing this. So my great task, and it took me a long time to know, was to recover the music and the sound and love the sound. I have a poem called The Singing Bowl, which has the line, "Stay with the music, words will come in time." Mm. Was to recover the sound, but not write in an archaic voice, not you with all the quoths and doths and prithies, which of course I did when I was first imitating Keats. So that's my aim. I just sing what I've got here. I mean, of course, I immediately think of poems that might illustrate that are in different books from this, but I did that to some degree in my book David's Crown, which was a series of responses to the Psalter. You know, I went right through the whole Psalter, and maybe I could read you. There's a Psalm 29 has this extraordinary series of things about the voice of the Lord. Mm-hmm. The voice of the Lord is mighty. The voice of the Lord teareth up the cedars and the terebinth trees. That's wonderful.
Yep.
This is my response to it. This is written in iambic pentameters, and it has a subtle rhyme scheme called terza rima, which I borrowed from Dante. But the idea is that the rhyme shouldn't, and the half rhyme shouldn't intrude itself upon you. It should be underneath. It's kind of just the underpinning of the poem. So it's got a kind of musical underscore. But I read this one simply because it is about hearing this voice. Call us, O Christ, and open up the gate. Call us to worship with your mighty voice. The voice that sings through rivers in full spate, the voice in which the forests all rejoice, the voice that rolls through thunderclouds and calls the deep seas and the steep waves, the quiet voice that stirs our sleeping conscience and recalls us to the love we had abandoned, leads us through the parting mists of doubt, or falls upon us like a revelation, pleads with us upon the poor's behalf, blazes in glory from each burning bush, and bleeds out from compassion's wounds, the voice that raises our drooping spirits till we dance for joy, and gives us too a voice to sing his praises.
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
We should probably wrap up. I want to ask another question, but it'll be another 15 minutes.
And yeah, sorry,
unfortunately, we all have schedules while we're here. Where can our listeners find your writings and your musings? I know you have lots of things going on.
So, I mean, the books are all out there, you know, from bookstores or Amazon. There's five collections of poetry. But a thing I started in lockdown, because I was still chaplain in my college and I couldn't get there for my students. And my way of being chaplain is just be there and somebody knocks on my door and say, oh, come in, and we'll have a chat and I read them something. So I started in lockdown a little YouTube channel called A Spell in the Library, where my wife kind of, you know, holds the iPhone and knocks on the door and is the proxy visitor and it's a kind of point of view. And I thought I'd do this, you know, we didn't know how big this thing was going to be. I mean, I thought I'd be doing this for a couple of months, for a couple of dozen students. And it just found a very wide audience. And people, I think, you know, just struggled to get. So it's now become, everybody wrote to me and said, don't stop, you know, when lockdown was over. So that I post pretty much weekly. Okay. It's called Guide Spell or something like that on YouTube. If you just go YouTube, Malcolm Gay. And basically, You open the video and it's like you are the hand that knocks on the door. And I quite often read poems or I do quite a lot about Tolkien and Lewis. I haven't really quite mastered what playlists are, but I'm trying to create some, you know, that, I mean, I didn't even know what YouTube was. I mean, I'm not a digital native. I taught myself the YouTube the first morning of the lockdown because, you know, there I was a very old fashioned kind of chaplain, and I suddenly had to reinvent myself as cyber chaplain, you know, and I had absolutely no idea how to do that. So, but I did work this thing out and was able to, and I still do that. I post, you know, weekly. And then I have a kind of members thing. Some people are saying, oh, I just, you know, don't give us more than 10 minutes, Malcolm, you know. So I created a sort of membership for the channel for people who are keen. And I read whole books, and I'm about a little over 2/3 of the way of reading the whole of Fantastics, chapter by chapter. Ooh. But I've read the whole of Dickens' A Christmas Carol. I've read the whole of The Wind in the Willows. So that's like a membership within a thing. People can sit down and get a good half hour or three quarters of an hour story time. You know?
That is good
so
stuff.
So there are two things. But the other, I mean, the little 10-minute spells are, you know, completely free and people can just enjoy them, you know.
Beautiful.
Because I've been doing it for about 5 years, there's plenty of back ones to look at. You can, you know, find what you like in there.
Absolutely. And we'll post those links in the show notes to this episode so everyone can find them. Malcolm Guyte, this has been so fun. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, and you know, glad to be here.
You can find all of our episodes at kfuo.org/Lutheran Ladies Lounge or on the KFUO radio app or on your favorite podcasting app. Also join us in the Facebook group, Lutheran Ladies Lounge, and our Instagram at Lutheran Ladies Lounge. You've been listening to the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast. I'm Sarah Golseth.
Views and opinions expressed on the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast may not represent the official position of the management or ownership of KFUO Radio, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. The Lutheran Ladies Lounge is produced by KFUO Radio and available at kfuo.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button and leave a review for us, too. If you love the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast, consider financially supporting our producer, KFUO Radio, so we can keep doing what we do. Find out how at kfuo.org/give.